This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Like the museums, schools, and banks of Iraq, many of the hospitals have been looted. My guest, Dr. Lynn Amowitz, has just returned from Iraq, where she was assessing conditions in hospitals. She also observed the chaos at mass graves that were just uncovered. Dr. Amowitz is senior medical researcher with Physicians for Human Rights, a group of healthcare professionals dedicated to the investigation and prevention of violations of international human rights and humanitarian law. She's a specialist in internal medicine, women's health, and epidemiology. Her work with Physicians for Human Rights has also taken her to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria. From late March until the end of last week, Dr. Amowitz traveled through the Iraqi cities of Nasiriyah, Umm Qasr, Najaf, Karbala, Hilla, and Baghdad. I asked her if hospital conditions were similar in the cities and villages she visited.
Conditions are not similar in Iraq. It depends on where you are. If you're in the north, it's very different from the south or even from central or Baghdad area. Remember that the previous regime favored Baghdad, and the Tikrit area did not favor the Shia areas and certainly didn't favor the Kurd areas. So much of the resources went to the central areas and into Baghdad. Hospitals in the south were dilapidated in many cases, unclean, did not have electricity, did not have water, did not have supplies, where initially some hospitals in Baghdad had a 3-month supply of drugs or had equipment. You can find MRIs in Baghdad. You cannot find MRIs in the south.
So Baghdad had MRIs, but in the south there were none.
No, there were none. And you were lucky if you could find an operating X-ray machine in the south or in the Shia areas.
Well, forget high tech. I mean, you've reported that doctors were reusing scalpels and using catheters and IVs for periods far longer than they're intended to be used. And that can result in terrible infections.
This is always the case, and, you know, whenever you're in a situation where supplies are short, you're always going to see things that are not supposed to be used more than once, to be reused. It was particularly bad for the maternity hospitals, where supplies for the maternity hospitals in particular had not been happening to the same level that they had been happening for other hospitals. And so you were seeing women having to use a urinary catheter for more than a month, or they were reusing scalpels and all kinds of other equipment.
What else did you see at the obstetric units?
The obstetric units were a completely separate case, and this was somewhat of a surprise to us because we had heard before we went in that the hospitals were sort of uniformly not well supplied or had supplies for 3 months but maybe didn't have some specific drugs. When we went into Nasiriyah, we went to visit the maternity and child hospital that was in Nasiriyah. We found, actually, in discussions with the female OBGYNs, that in fact they had not had drugs that were specific for women for the last 5 years. They had no anesthetic, and they were doing the episiotomies, which is to cut the skin so that the baby can come out easier without any type of anesthesia whatsoever, when the other hospitals had anesthesia. Not more than a 5-minute drive away.
Are there many women dying in childbirth now because of the bad sanitation and lack of electricity?
Maternal mortality, or women dying in and around childbirth, is relatively high in Iraq. The number quoted by UNICEF is 294 women die for every 100,000 live births. If you look at that number compared to Afghanistan, where it was 1,600 per 100,000, it doesn't sound like a huge number. But if you compare it to the U.S., which is 8 per 100,000, and you look at the Iraqi medical system, you have to wonder why it should be so high. And there are many reasons that women die in childbirth. They are usually because of lack of hospitals that can care for women that have complications in pregnancy. And we saw quite a bit of this in several of the hospitals in the areas that we were in. In addition, over the last 10 years, there's been more than a doubling of infant mortality cases and children dying under the age of 5. So the Iraqi healthcare system has certainly declined over the last 10 years and will probably continue to do so unless this is paid attention to.
No, it sounds like the problems that you were seeing at the hospitals in Iraq were were from a combination of things. Some of the problems were just because of sanctions. Some of the problems were because Saddam Hussein was totally unfair in how he allocated funding for hospitals. Some of the problems were because of the bombing. Some of the problems were post-war problems because of the looting and the anarchy. Am I being accurate in saying that?
I think that's completely accurate. I think it is multifactorial.
But what held it all together is that all the hospitals you went to were in terrible shape.
It's hard to say that they were in terrible shape. They were not in a shape that you would want to get care in. I think one of the most surprising things is that you forget how necessary it is to have water and what a simple loss of water can do to a hospital. There's nothing to clean with. There's no water to clean hands. There's no water to clean instruments. So the hospitals were filthy, and you were spending most of your time batting away flies and trying to listen to the needs of the doctors and the nurses and the hospital staff. And you were just amazed at how many flies could gather in one place.
Now, the lack of water, was that because of the bombing of infrastructure?
Part of the lack of water was bombing of infrastructure. Part of it was some of the holdouts from Saddam's regime that went and purposely cut water lines and cut water mains. There was another problem that we discovered, which was not expected, was that as the water supplies and the pumping stations lost electricity and weren't able to pump water to houses, people started digging down into the water mains. And we saw this in Nasiriyah, that they would dig down to the water main, punch holes in the water main, put hoses in, and then siphon off the water into those houses. Now, what that does is make a closed system now open. And so even if you're able to get the water pumping again, you're going to have a completely contaminated system. And then you have to go around and really start plugging all these holes that are being put in the water main system.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Lynn Amowitz. She's a senior medical researcher with Physicians for Human Rights, and she was in Iraq from the end of March through just a few days ago. Some of the medical aid to Iraq has come in the form of donated field hospitals. What are those field hospitals?
The field hospitals in Iraq were given by governments around the world. I think the intention was that these would substitute, and definitely these political governments thought that these would substitute for care in Iraq. The problem is that they set up a parallel system of care. Iraq is not one of those places that had no health care system. You have a community of physicians that prior to the 1980s were all subspecialty trained in the West and were highly trained and technical. One of the things that we saw as we were going through the hospitals was a very elaborate echocardiogram reports and catheterization reports from highly trained physicians. So for a government to send in a field hospital that's supposed to substitute for what's already there was not the best way of handling any type of aid or care to the hospitals. It would have been far better to figure out what was needs-based, go to the hospital, find out what's missing and supply that, as opposed to taking a very expensive field hospital, bringing it in and not using the Iraqi health professionals that are already there. Parallel systems only create an expectation of the Iraqi civilians that it's better care. They see it as these big fancy tents and lots of doctors who are not Iraqi, and they feel that that's better. And it really changes the relationship between the doctors and the patients within Iraq.
Now, you mentioned that the obstetrics units were having a lot of problems. Were there other problems that you found in your tour of Iraqi hospitals that seemed unique to women?
I think one of the things that is probably unique to women in Iraq is that we don't know anything about their needs or their desires. They have not had a voice for years. And similar to Afghanistan, there is a lot of assumptions that are made about them and about what they need. For one interesting thing that we found was that the Ministry of Health, which was a male-dominated Ministry of Health, had made rules and regulations about who could and could not get birth control. And when you ask the female physicians or the OBGYNs about this, were very adamant that those rules needed to go as the regime went and as there were new rules made within the Ministry of Health. They also felt that birth control should be free and that it should be supplied, because apparently over the last 5 years in many of the hospitals, it was very difficult to get birth control and any type of medicine that was specific for women.
Gee, what was the Iraqi government's criteria for deciding which women get birth control and what kind they get?
They had this very elaborate system of deciding how many children you had, whether you had medical problems or not, whether it would be a danger to you to have more children. But the decisions were always made by someone else, not by the patient or the patient and her husband alone.
Did you find that there were any fears within the Iraqi medical community about Islamic fundamentalists gaining more control in the country and how that might affect health care?
There was a concern as we were starting to wind down our activities over the last couple of weeks. A lot of the clerics, the Islamic fundamentalists, were taking over many of the clinics and hospitals, including taking over hospitals with force. We had reports in Baghdad of several hospitals being taken over with AK-47s. The concern that we had was that this type of takeover, and what the clerics were doing was saying, well, you know, we're filling the gap. We're going to pay the salaries of the doctors. We're going to give you security. We have lots of money. We're going to give you the supplies that you need. So the hospitals and the hospital administrators were thankful for all of these things. But it was also somewhat clear that there was a little bit of fear of what would happen once that gap was filled. And we had a concern that we still have not been able to substantiate very well, that women's health care would suffer under another Islamic fundamentalist regime, that we've seen this in Afghanistan, that when you have this type of fundamentalism, that women are usually the ones who suffer the most, and that they could possibly make policies within clinics that would affect women, such as women cannot be examined by men no matter what, or women cannot get birth control, or there are certain drugs that cannot be given to women. And I think only time will tell and further investigation, but this is a great concern.
My guest is Dr. Lynn Amowitz, senior medical researcher with Physicians for Human Rights. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Lynn Amowitz, senior medical researcher with Physicians for Human Rights. She just returned from Iraq, where she was assessing conditions in hospitals. Now, in addition to touring the hospitals of Iraq, you also visited the sites of mass graves. What did you see? Like, which graves did you visit, and what did you see?
Some of the graves I will not talk about, only because we're trying to protect some of those from being identified. Some of the ones that I did see were between Karbala and Najaf, and have already been dug up mainly by bulldozers and by family members, you know, deeply searching for their loved ones. But what you find when you go to these areas are just piles of bones and clothing and shoes. And one of the more surprising things to me was to see so many female skeletons, you know, skeletons that clearly had longer hair or were still had the black headscarf around their head. And you find things like bullet holes in the heads. You would see wrists that were still tied together with this nylon rope. And it wouldn't just be one pair of wrists. It would be many pairs of wrists.
Now, I know a lot of people were going through the mass graves, trying to see if they could find evidence of loved ones they had who had disappeared. How are they doing that? Because unless you find an article of clothing, I mean, you can't identify bones without scientific, that's like scientific lab work. You can't just like find bones and figure out whether that's your husband or your son or your daughter.
You're exactly right. And what happens when family members start looking for their loved ones, if it's not the first body they come across, they sort of just pass those bones off to the side. Unfortunately, there were lots of victims that were buried in their clothes. And at that time, particularly in the early 90s, you had to carry an identification card in the pocket. And so many of the skeletons were found with an identification card in the pocket. And if that family was somehow lucky, they were able to find out if that was their loved one. If it wasn't their loved one, they just sort of pushed it aside, or a bulldozer came and pushed it aside. And then that card is now separated from the skeleton, and everything is blowing in the wind. So it does leave a huge problem for those who want to find their loved ones. And in some cases, I think that they were probably just taking bones, wrapping them in the shrouds that are so traditional for the Shia, and taking them for burial because of this need to have something, to have a family member back.
What is usually done at the site of a mass grave to protect against this kind of chaos?
Protection of mass grave sites has to have U.S. troops. At this point, the U.S. has not done this. And you have to have some type of security. But at the same time that you're securing the site, you also need to say why you're securing the site. You need to talk with local leaders. You need to educate the community as to what the process will be and why it's important, and to reassure them that, you know, the bones are not the property of anybody but the families, and they will be theirs. However, there has to be an orderly process to do it so that it's fair to everybody.
One of the things that I believe you investigated was whether doctors were asked to participate in torture sessions. And this has been a problem for many years, where there are doctors who are kind of pressed into doing this, pressed by the state. Did you find this in Iraq?
We did find this in Iraq. In Basra and Nasiriyah and in Najaf, we found physicians who were willing to tell us that they had been threatened by the previous regime into doing things that they would not normally have done, such as one of the problems with not wanting to be in Saddam's army was that if you refused, and remember, most of his army was forced conscripted or forced to fight. And if you somehow refused, the penalty was to have your right ear cut off. What the regime would do is that they would bring these deserters, or these young men who refused to enter the army, to the surgeons in a hospital, and they would then threaten the doctors and tell them that they had to cut off the right ear.
And what was the penalty if the doctor refused?
The doctor refused. We heard reports of them being threatened to be killed, or the family would be threatened to be killed or even tortured. In other cases, we also heard that many of them simply heard that the, quote, security persons were coming with these young men, and they would take emergency leave and go away for a month and hope that some other doctor was forced to do this. In that way, they would get out of it. It was a survival technique that they tried to employ to get out of having to do something like this.
Now, how did you find out about this?
We actually asked the doctors directly what had happened over the last few years, and what had they been forced to do that they didn't want to do. And in a flood of conversation in one hospital in particular, we had four older physicians that had been working in a hospital in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and they basically said to us, you know what, we've had this on our mind forever. We need to get it off our chest. Here's what happened.
And what else did you hear besides cutting off of ears and punishment for young men who didn't join the army?
Physicians were also asked to administer the mercy bullets in people that were being tortured, victims that were tortured by the regime. If the torture didn't kill them, they were brought to the hospital, or a doctor was brought to the torture chamber, which was not usually that far from the hospital. It was usually the police station or some other security building close to one of the hospitals. And they were asked to administer the mercy bullet to kill the patient. Or they may have been asked to say whether the torture victim was dead or alive. If the doctor had said that he was alive when he was really dead, the consequences were swift for the doctor as well, or if he pronounced him dead when he was really alive, then the doctor would also be in trouble. So this was a dilemma for the doctors. And when we asked the doctors what they did in a case where it was a no-win situation for them, one of the doctors sort of looked at the floor, shuffled his feet, and said, I don't remember what I did.
Why would you need a doctor to deliver the mercy bullet? I mean, couldn't any old torturer just shoot somebody in the head and kill them?
Of course they could, but this was, you know, techniques were to intimidate, to make sure that leaders within the community were afraid and would do whatever they were told by anybody. It was a very oppressive regime.
Are there a couple of other countries that you can mention in which doctors have been forced to participate in state-sponsored torture?
I think there are 60 countries around the world that use torture that is state-sponsored, and many of those physicians are asked to be complicit. Pakistan has been noted in that, Kosovo in the recent years. Turkey is another one.
Dr. Lynn Amowitz is senior medical researcher for Physicians for Human Rights. She traveled through Iraq in April and the first half of May. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.